It's Morning Edition on WNYC. I'm Richard Hake. It's peak summer, time to hit the beach, swim in the ocean, and resume our national ritual of freaking out about sharks.
Holy
Shark Week. It's a bad week to be a seal.
That's an ad for cable TV's Shark Week, which begins this weekend on the heels of the movie Sharknado 2. WNYC's Jim O'Grady reports that America's obsession with sharks dates to long before the book and the movie Jaws from the 1970s. The shark story begins in 1916 with a series of attacks along the Jersey Shore and includes a forgotten act of selflessness.
As Stanley Fisher lay next to a creek in Mattawan, New Jersey, he turned to Willie, an assistant in his tailor shop, and said, "Don't take any new suit orders until I get back." Fisher meant when he got back from the hospital and recovered from the shark bite to his leg. It's the kind of thing you say when you're the son of a sea captain, when you're 6'2" and 24 years old and a leading man in the life of your town. When you're a guy like that and you're in your shop on a summer afternoon and four boys come running down Main Street shouting that their friend Lester has been taken down by a shark in the creek, you change into your bathing suit, grab some guys, and run to the scene. At the time, sharks are considered just another fish. Experts say the animals are shy and pose no threat to swimmers. But by mid-July of 1916, that's changing. Everyone knows that in the previous 2 weeks, two men have been killed in separate attacks off the Jersey Shore. But that was in the ocean, not a tidal creek 2 miles from the beaches of Lower New York Bay. When Stanley Fisher arrives on the scene, he hops in a rowboat and floats on the murky water, using a pole to probe for Lester. As he works, the banks fill up with people from the town, repeating the story by Lester's friends, how Lester was floating on his back when a shadow rose from below, came closer, gained speed, and then struck the boy and lifted him in the air before taking him under. Stanley knows that too much time has passed to make this a rescue anymore. It's the recovery of a body. That means Stanley's next move is to lay down his pole, jump in the creek, and dive deep. But why? Why dive into water that might still be prowled by a killer shark when saving a life is no longer possible?
In 600 feet, continue onto Morristown Road.
If you go to Mattawan today, it's still a sleepy hamlet in central New Jersey, you'll find the town's official historian, who's been thinking about that question for a long time.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi.
I'm Al. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
He's Al Savaline, retired history teacher and high school principal, a grandfather with a thin white mustache, and he's spent decades researching the shark attacks. He's been consulted as an expert by the authors of books and the makers of movies. He leads cemetery tours to the graves of the people involved in the story. The first thing he does is drive me to the creek, where he talks about Lester as if he knew him.
Lester Stilwell was one of the poorest boys. His father worked in the basket factory, but he was trying to be like the other boys. The other boys were bigger and stronger. He was on the frail side. But instead of just sitting back and watching, he wanted to be part of the action.
Savaline says Lester was an epileptic and only 12 years old when he and his friends went down to the creek.
Boys, you know, wealthy boys and poor boys swimming and being friends and having relationships like that.
Mattawan in 1916 was your classic American small town. Pretty much everyone would have known Lester and Stanley. So on July 12th, when Stanley is in a rowboat searching for Lester, the eyes of the town are upon him, including Lester's parents, who are standing on the bank. They watch Stanley dive in. They don't ask why.
This goes back to really Victorian times. There was this concept of what they called a good death. This was a case that it was very important, not just to the Stilwell family, but to the town, that this shark didn't win the game, that the body is recovered so they can have a Christian burial and at least do that for Lester.
Over and over, Stanley Fisher and other young men fill their lungs before plunging underwater. Over and over, they find nothing. After a while, everyone but Stanley gives up.
And Stanley made one last dive, went down, located Lester's body. But when he was down there, he noticed something was near the body. something is moving around by the body. So he grabbed the body and he started lifting it up. And on the way up, the shark attacked Stanley and took a huge gash out of his right leg. Severing the artery, a really horrible mess. But he was a big guy. He came up and he was pounding the shark. And there are people down there watching him. There were some men in rowboats were coming near him, but he was doing most of the fighting himself. But they were finally able to get Stanley off to the shore.
They carry Stanley to a wharf where Willie, his assistant, sits next to him. And that's when Stanley tells Willie not to take any new suit orders.
Then he realized, the significance of his wound. And he said, "Willie, if something happens to me, take care of my sister."
Stanley is taken by train to a hospital in Long Branch, where he lives only another hour.
His last words, according to the doctor with him, was that, "I got Lester away from the shark. I did my duty."
He did. But Stanley also dropped the body when the shark attacked him. It wasn't until 2 days later that an old sailor recovered Lester's mutilated corpse at the foot of a nearby bridge. The question then becomes, what sort of creature kills four people in 12 days? Despite the drumbeat of pop culture, this is not typical shark behavior. The leading theory among today's scientists is that the attacks were carried out by an unusual animal acting in an unusual way.
Rogue, so to speak, not a sharkula, not a vampire of the deep, but perhaps an atypical, injured, sick, or otherwise estranged individual.
That's Richard Fernicola, author of the book 12 Days of Terror.
It could not compete with the others of its own species and had to end up closer to shore and was almost forced into this bizarre behavior, found it fairly easy to latch on to, an awkward pseudo-marine mammal, namely a human being.
The attacks, like the shark itself, were one of a kind. In the history of the Atlantic seaboard, only four deaths have been attributed to the great white shark, and nothing like the 1916 attacks has happened since. Except in the movies, like Jaws.
That's a 20-footer.
25.
The shark in Mattawan Creek was 8 feet long. 2 days later, a pair of fishermen netted it in Lower New York Bay. One of the fishermen took the shark to his home on 125th Street in Harlem, embalmed it, then put it on display in the ground floor window of a newspaper office. The display included human bones that were removed from the shark's stomach. 30,000 people lined up to gaze on what the press was calling the man-eater. It was the 1916 equivalent of a blockbuster movie, and for sharks as a species, their public debut as a monster. For WNYC, I'm Jim O'Grady.